So in Pennsylvania, you know, in neighboring Pennsylvania, for example, there are, in convenience stores, there are quote unquote skill-based slot machines that have popped up. They look like a duck, they quack like a duck, they talk like a duck, they certainly look like slot machines. And the legal justification is, no, there is an element of skill to them, and therefore they are not slot machines. They are amusement devices that you can play and win money on and whatnot, but they are not slot machines.
I'm Sarah Grass, and this is episode 2 of season 2 of Hearsay from the Sidelights, a show about the place where law, sports, and culture intersect. Brought to you by Culture and Sports and Seton Hall Law School's Gaming, Hospitality, Entertainment, and Sports Law program. This season is focusing on the explosive growth of the online sports betting industry as legalization sweeps across the country, and looking at the impact it's having on our relationships with our favorite pastimes. Today, I'm laying some groundwork to help those outside the gaming space understand the state laws and regulations that govern sports betting in the U.S., and look at where these state laws intersect with federal law. While episode 3 will focus on the history of sports betting, including the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, PASPA, and the decision in Murphy v. NCAA, which appended the federal ban on sports betting, my focus for this episode is to familiarize you with how the legal sports betting industry operates. I want to start with something super basic, which is, what is gambling? Easy. New Jersey defines gambling in Section 2C of its criminal statutes as staking or risking something of value upon the outcome of a contest of chance or a future contingent event, not under the actor's control or influence, upon an agreement or understanding that he will receive something of value in the event of a certain outcome. End quote. The term bet or wager in the U.S. code is almost identical. It simply makes some additions, including a contest of others, a sporting event, or a game subject to chance. But if you pay to virtually draft 3 players and compete to see who can score the most points or get the most yards to win a cash prize, this is considered fantasy sports, not gambling, and is specifically carved out as permissible under the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act, which I'll tell you more about in a minute. Or you can buy a $100 contract that will be worth $417 if South Carolina wins the women's college basketball championships, and $130 if they don't, without technically placing a bet. This is an event contract offered on Kalshi, a federally regulated financial exchange, so also not gambling. And even though these examples may look like ducks, quack like ducks, and are treated by consumers very much like ducks, according to our existing laws and regulations, there are some other type of bird entirely. I'll talk in much greater detail about fantasy sports in the next episode, but here's Mark Edelman describing the difficulty with drawing a bright line between real sports betting and fantasy sports.
Now, my interpretation of the legal definition that was adopted by Congress in 2006 of fantasy sports separates fantasy sports from sports gambling in two important ways. Now, and keep in mind, there are companies that call themselves fantasy sports that, in my mind, are sports gambling. The first distinction is, are you betting on, are you making predictions based upon collections of players or individual game results? And if it's a game result activity or even a single player result activity, that would put you, in my view, in sports betting. If you're making a lineup of several players, that would put you in the category of fantasy sports. And that's one part of the test, but that's not the whole test. The other very meaningful part of the test is sports gambling or sports wagering involve activities where there's a side that's operating as the house. So you are betting against an entity. Now, that is different from fantasy sports, where it's participant against participant, or using the words from the code, relative skill of the players, where the host of this is taking an operating fee, but does not have any financial interest in who wins. They end up in the exact same place economically, irrespective of how the different participants do. Now, that is getting confounded by companies today that are calling themselves daily fantasy sports, but in my view are actually operating prop betting sites. And I'm not going to mention them by name, but some of them have actually been licensed in a limited number of states.
You'll hear much more from Mark about fantasy sports soon, but I only wanted to introduce them now to just highlight that laws and regulations about sports betting only impact a narrow segment of a bunch of activities that practically look very similar. When we say that gambling on sports is legal in the U.S., what that means is that there is no federal law explicitly making sports betting illegal. This means that states have the right to independently legalize and regulate sports betting within their own borders. But there are still some federal laws in place relevant to the gaming industry. We'll have to get into a little bit of history here just to explain the context in which these laws were created. Before the 1960s, states were pretty much on their own to regulate gambling. But in 1961, concerns about the growth of organized crime led to the passage of three pieces of federal legislation: the Interstate Wire Act, the Travel Act, and the Interstate Transportation of Wagering Paraphernalia Act. To be clear, these laws were really not aimed at restricting individuals from betting on sports. They were intended to prevent the mob from operating large-scale illegal gambling operations across state lines. The first of these, the Wire Act, prohibits anyone engaged in the business of gambling from using telecommunication systems to, one, transmit bets or wagers or information that helps in the placing of those bets on, quote, any sporting event or contest, unquote, and, two, transmit a communication that allows, quote, the recipient to receive money or credit as a result of bets or wagers, or for information assisting in the placing of bets or wagers, unquote. The Travel Act criminalizes interstate or foreign commerce, which includes travel, mail, or other facilities, to promote unlawful activities, which may include gambling in some locations, but also includes many other things that violate state or federal laws. Then there's the Paraphernalia Act, which prohibits interstate transportation of materials and devices that facilitate illegal gambling. This particular law applies only to tangible things, which makes it much less relevant when gambling is mostly happening online. In 1970, Congress enacted the Illegal Gambling Business Act, or IGBA. IGBA subjects anyone who controls, manages, or finances an illegal gambling business to fines and/or imprisonment of up to 5 years. Under IGBA, an illegal gambling business is an entity that, one, violates the laws of the state where it operates, two, involves five or more people who oversee or manage the business, and three, has been in operation for more than 30 days or grosses more than $2,000 in any single day. For the purposes of this statute, the term gambling includes a wide array of activities. In keeping with Congress's focus on organized, unlawful gambling, IGBA isn't triggered unless the business violates state or local laws. Finally, there's the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act, or UGEA, which was enacted in 2006. UGEA was designed to control online gambling by targeting payment processing. The statute makes it a crime to knowingly accept most forms of payment, including credit, electronic fund transfers, checks, or drafts payable through a financial institution, or the proceeds of any other financial transaction in connection with the participation of another person in unlawful internet gambling. Unlawful internet gambling covers the transmission of bets or wagers via the internet where those wagers violate federal or state law. In other words, UGEA prevents payment processors from accepting funds from anyone other than explicitly legal online gambling sites. Outside of these federal laws, which are geared towards eliminating large-scale or organized unlawful gambling businesses, not on punishing individual gamblers, each state is on its own in choosing when, where, and how sportsbooks can legally operate. As of the time this episode was recorded, sports betting is legal in 39 U.S. states and the District of Columbia, with four additional states actively considering legislation or ballot initiatives to legalize. Of these, 31 in the District of Columbia allow mobile sports betting. And it probably comes as no surprise that there is significant variation across jurisdictions in what is allowed and what is restricted. The National Council on Problem Gambling's 2024 Online Sports Betting Regulations report highlights this quite clearly. Some requirements are universal, like age verification, But while the minimum age to bet on sports is 21 in most states, 5 allow it for individuals as young as 18. While most have self-exclusion programs where those who feel the need can block themselves from betting online, requirements that customers be provided access to information on responsible versus problem gambling is far from universal. Many states allow betting on credit cards, and a handful have virtually no restrictions on advertising content, including marketing to underage audiences. The American Gaming Association's 2024 report details some other interesting differences between jurisdictions, including restrictions on bets placed on college teams. Some states, like New Jersey, prohibit bets on New Jersey college teams, regardless of where they are playing. Others restrict only prop bets on in-state collegiate athletes, while others have no restrictions at all. And then there's the financial differences. New York imposes serious fees and tax rates on sportsbooks, $25 million for the initial license and a 51% tax rate for online revenue. Right across the border in New Jersey, an annual license is $100,000 and the tax rate is only 14.25%. States with brick-and-mortar casinos and racetracks often require sports betting licenses to be tied to physical locations and limit the number of these, quote, skins that can be affiliated with each. New Jersey is one of these states. Here's longtime industry insider Bill Pascrell III, VP3, to give some context as to why requirements like these are imposed and the impact they have on land-based gambling businesses.
There's no proof anywhere in the globe that anytime you regulate a digital game, that it cannibalizes brick and mortar retail, number one. Number two, they're not offering it anyway, right? So what they would argue is it's a zero-sum game. Our poker player's now not going to bet on, you know, poker, he's going to bet on sport. Well, first of all, she and he are already betting on sport, but they're doing it in the black market, number one. And number two, it's another way for you to get butts in your seat. How do you do that? You create a gaming lounge. People come in, drink beer, have a martini, watch the games, right? Everybody knows why the red zone was created. The red zone's created where you can pop around in multiple games when a team's coming into the red zone to score, because that's what people care about, right? They're engaged on this. We're not advocating to bet over your head. We're advocating for people to have the option to bet and to advocate for betting in the legal market because of all the metrics I mentioned before, from consumer protection, RG, jobs, taxes, et cetera. But the state didn't put anything in place to protect the casinos other than the law that says in order to have a sports betting license, you must be tethered to a brick and mortar casino. And a brick-and-mortar racetrack. So we know we have sports betting retail at Monmouth Park Racetrack, where Dennis Drazen, my dear friend, is, and client. Jeff Gural at his Meadowlands Racetrack, and in all the 10 casinos, which used to be 12, by the way. The best thing that ever happened, ever, was when brick-and-mortar casinos, 2 of the 12 in AC, closed before our ballot referendum passed. Then you fast forward, Professor, to the pandemic. Were it not for online casino and poker and online sports betting, I guarantee you, and I've said this before, and I can back it up, every one of those casinos would have closed. Okay? So now, the other thing that's nuanced, but is proven out, bears out, is that you now have a new mechanism to attract clients. Mm-hmm. Because now I have all this data of when Professor Grass and Bill Pascrell come online to a sports betting operator. I'm not going to mention names because then it means like I'm advocating for one over the other. But any of them, now that casino can come out to you and me and say, hey, Bill, by the way, Beyonce's coming to this casino. Or would you like to come in and have 50% off your room? Or go to a dinner or a show or whatever. They didn't have that. They didn't understand the value proposition of the marketing, the massive marketing that's been spent by all the dozens of operators in New Jersey to advocate, because, you know, each casino can have up to 3 sports books.
State legislation and regulation obviously requires state regulators. I had the opportunity to interview Lou Rogacki, Deputy Director at the New Jersey Division of Gaming Enforcement, which sits within the office of the New Jersey Attorney General. He gave me an overview of the role DGE plays in regulating gambling, including sports betting, in the state of New Jersey.
Sure. Our enabling statute is pretty broad, especially with regard to casino gaming and the casinos and sports wagering and internet gaming. We obviously don't. There are separate agencies that do legalized games of chance, all the boardwalk amusement games. There's a separate lottery commission. There's a racing commission that does all the horse racing in the state. We work very closely with them now that the racetracks since 2018 have gotten sports wagering lounges. But it's separate dual jurisdiction with regard to the specific items that we're regulating. Other than that, when it comes to casinos, internet gaming, or sports wagering, the enabling statutes, specifically NJSA 512-55, which sets up the division, as well as 512-76, which sets out all our powers, they're pretty broad and expansive of what we have the ability to do. We have dual regulatory powers with a casino control commission in the state. It's a little bit different now since 2011 and some statutory reforms, which switched some of the regulatory responsibilities over from the commission to the Division of Gaming Enforcement. Prior to 11, we were primarily the investigative arm, for lack of a better term, for the Casino Control Commission. Now items with regard to the actual licensure of casinos, as well as casino employee licenses, still are investigated by us and reported on by us, but they go through the Casino Control Commission in Atlantic City. But with regard to all those things I talked about before on what I'll call my side of the house, service industry licensing, all the vendors, all the casino enterprises, that all the services ancillary to operating a casino. All of that goes through just our director, and it can be appealed to the Casino Control Commission, but we do it all in-house now.
When you consider that Murphy was decided in May of 2018, clearing the way for any interested state to legalize sports betting, the fact that so many states have already done so is a pretty amazing feat. To be fair, if you include tribal gaming, gambling was already legal in 43 states, which means that in most states there were already regulations and agencies in place to oversee this new market segment. Still, for states that had previously been focused more on land-based gaming, like casinos and horse racing, the introduction of sports betting meant some major shifts had to happen in a short time span.
A little over a decade ago, we had land-based casino wagering in Atlantic City. That was it. You know, there were certain companies dabbling with, you know, the ability to, over your TV, there would be a certain channel that you could do some remote gaming from your room. And that was cutting edge in 2009, 2011. And then suddenly we had the regulatory reform. And shortly on the heels of that, of getting all that set up and all our processes and procedures, all of a sudden we had the legislature passed internet gaming. And, you know, although we went from land-based that was 24/7, now suddenly we were dealing with these remote systems, mostly companies from Europe that we had never dealt with before. And the governor gave us 9 months to get live. And, you know, it was pretty much a whirlwind trying to learn an entire new industry to regulate in 9 months, as well as license at that time about 30 companies to come into the space to go live by November of 2013. And we got that done. And, you know, you sat back for about a week and thought, wow, we made it through that. Now I can relax a little bit. And then the next wave of companies came in that said, we didn't think you could pull that off. Now we want to come into this space. We wanted to make sure it wasn't going to fail. And then it started the revolving door of more and more companies wanting to be involved in internet gaming. And the whole time with an undercurrent that we were fighting in federal court against the leagues to try to legalize sports wagering and overturn PASPA, which ultimately happened in May of 2018. And, you know, the most overused word now is game changer. But that was a game changer as far as, you know, I mean, systems and operators and everything. So what it looks like regulating gaming today versus 10, 15 years ago, night and day, they don't even look the same. I mean, same concepts, same basic concepts. We didn't change much as far as, you know, licensing structures. We didn't add any licenses other than what was required by statute. But as far as the actual operators, we fit them into our service industry licensing categories and didn't need to create new systems or licensor structures. So for the most part, you know, the concepts are all the same. You know, good character, honesty, and integrity is still a cornerstone of what we do. But, you know, it's a completely different industry than it was 10, 15 years ago.
But state agencies aren't overseeing the sports betting industry alone. Realistically, they probably couldn't. The gaming industry itself bears much of the responsibility for policing itself through self-regulation. But what does that really mean, self-regulation? In the context of sportsbooks, it means they bear much of the responsibility for monitoring who is placing bets and what bets are being placed to ensure that they are not facilitating violations of state and federal laws and regulations. And this is a big job. It involves tools to verify the identities and locations of bettors to confirm they are who they say they are, that they're of legal age, not barred from betting, located within the boundaries of the state, and that they have not voluntarily self-excluded. It means tracking the flow of their funds to guard against money laundering, fraud, and theft, while also ensuring that customers receive the funds to which they're entitled. Sportsbooks also need to keep all advertising and promotions within the legal bounds, while also facilitating profit generation and customer engagement. Finally, they have to constantly monitor thousands of events and the wagers placed on them for suspicious activity. It's not surprising, then, that gaming companies have whole compliance teams who work with state regulators to keep this complex regulatory structure intact. My interview with Lou Rogacki also included longtime gaming industry colleague Chris Soriano, who is currently the Vice President and Chief Compliance Officer for Penn Entertainment. Chris is an attorney with a long history in New Jersey's gaming industry, so not surprisingly, he and Lou are on very familiar terms.
Chris is, as the compliance officer, and I'd say this if it was any other operator sitting here, the Chief Compliance Officer is the first person who gets the angry phone call from me, the regulator, when something goes wrong. You know, and then we go from there. You know, it's, I have said this at AML conferences. My favorite people in the industry are the compliance people because they're the ones who try to see it from my perspective and are viewed within their organization as the no people, that they're always saying no. And that's how, you know, the regulator is often viewed. There are often times when Chris and I disagree on something. And, you know, it comes down to the company's policy. And so Chris is always juggling that versus I'm coming at it as the regulator saying, here's what the statute says. Here's what the reg says. Maybe there's some interpretation there and we can have a conversation about that. But you need to do X, Y, and Z, and then he has to have that conversation within his organization.
Yeah, I think, you know, Lou, you said it well. You know, the relationship between compliance and the regulators, you know, we're very interesting as an industry in that I can't speak for everybody. The vast majority of us, you know, let's talk about situations where something is going wrong. The vast majority of us believe very, very strongly in self-reporting and in contacting the regulator and self-reporting to the regulator that something has gone wrong or we've committed a violation of something or X, Y, or Z has happened. You know, that is, in order to do that, you've got to be able to encapsulate it, explain it to the regulator, lay it out. And sometimes, you know, one of the more interesting aspects of that relationship, Sarah, is that you sometimes don't know. And we recently discussed this at a conference we were all recently at down in South Carolina. We talked about this. Sometimes in compliance, something might be going on, but you're not sure yet. You don't know. You just don't know because it's something is just bubbling up. We saw something strange and we're not sure. Did a system fail? Is it a glitch? You know, did everything's fine and it's the data's coming out of the machine wrong? Like it could be any number of things. And in those circumstances, and I teach this and I practice law this way, and that's what I do now, is you pick up the phone and call the regulator confidentially and say, I think we might have something going on here, but I don't have any of the answers to the questions I know you're going to ask me. So please give me a little bit of runway in order to be able to do my investigation, get back to you. I may call you back and say this was completely nothing. Or I may call you back and say, hey, we found an issue and here's what we did to remediate it, or something in between. And I'm impressed with state gaming regulators around the country who, I mean, if you think about it, you're in charge of regulating this. I'm putting myself in lieu or any of his colleagues in 30 some odd other jurisdictions. Somebody just called you and said, we think something's wrong, but we don't know anything about it yet. That puts you in a weird spot. You know, it puts you in a weird spot. As I have to imagine, it puts you in a weird spot. But it's the reality of the world where we'd rather report something, you know, over disclose something, report it in advance, and then say, and now we need a little bit of time to look at it. And so that I think is a critical aspect of relationships between operators and regulators, is just that ability to be able to sometimes say, I don't have all the answers for you right now. But here's my plan for how I'm going to get them, and I'll be back to you when I do. And expect, you know, certainly the expectation, and it's never not happened in those circumstances, is the regulator typically will say, thanks for the call. Give me a call tomorrow and let me know how it's going, or something, you know, or something like that. It's unusual. You know, it's unusual in that you're self-reporting, A, you know, you're self-reporting potentially your own error or issue. And B, you're doing so sometimes with imperfect information that you need a little bit more time to gather.
As Chris's comments highlight, identifying possible integrity issues in sports betting requires data. Countless microtransactions are happening at every hour of the day as consumers wager on virtually every sport happening around the world. Fortunately for regulators and operators, and unfortunately for bad actors, someone is always watching, gathering and crunching information from leagues, sportsbooks, social media, and more, screening for patterns and red flags, ready to take action on possible issues 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. A colleague connected me with Matt Holt, president of IC360, formerly US Integrity, one of the leading third-party integrity monitors in the sports betting industry. Here's how he described their work.
So we're a game integrity, fraud prevention, sports betting compliance firm. And essentially, we work with about every stakeholder in the ecosystem. You know, we work with about every major professional and collegiate sports team and league you could name, NFL, NBA, NHL, MLB, PGA, UFC, NASCAR, every college conference with D1 football, 29 of the 32 collegiate conferences with D1 basketball. All the way down to the very smallest league, Slap Fight, American Cornhole. I mean, we have over 250 league clients. We work with over 108 licensed sportsbook operators in North America. And we are licensed in, I think, 39 or 40 states now, as well as the District of Columbia, as well as Ontario, Puerto Rico, and doing a little work down in Brazil and the Philippines as well. And essentially, we pull in real-time data sets, whether it's odds data, real-time wagering data as it happens, live event and statistical data, anonymous reporting, real-time scrubbing of social media. And our system, using AI, just looks for abnormalities. When those abnormalities are detected, they get sent to an analyst for further review. If an analyst determines that there could be nefarious, suspicious, or abnormal activity, we send out an alert to all of the operators and regulators in the industry. We average probably 15 to 20 alerts a month, 75% plus of which lead to suspensions, bans, or arrests related to nefarious or illicit sports betting activity.
Integrity monitoring requires deep knowledge of the sports themselves, as well as the complex laws and regulations governing sports betting.
It's really important that they have an understanding of the sport, which is why we assign analysts to specific sports leagues, teams, regions, jurisdictions, etc. And it's not just the rules of the actual event or sport that they're watching, but, you know, in the U.S., it's a state-by-state issue, not, you know, sports betting isn't a federal issue. So it's 50 states, 50 very different sets of rules. But when you also combine the fact that there's over 240 tribal gaming jurisdictions in the U.S., and each of those negotiate their own compact, essentially their own set of rules, the U.S. is really a 50 states, about a 290 sets of rules issue. And that's where the complications really come in. How are these wagers in this jurisdiction affected? You know, is it a regulatory violation, a league policy violation, or potentially actually a criminal act? And the same act in different jurisdictions can have a very different impact or result.
Technology is an integral tool in integrity monitoring because it speeds up the process of data review so exponentially. But it's still not a fully automated process. There's a lot of human intervention required.
So a lot of it starts off with fairly simplistic or what we would consider normalized data sets like you would see in the financial services world. In the financial services world, you know, firms are required to report each and every trade. Well, in this regulated sports betting world, in many states with data mandates, we get each and every bet, which is no different than a trade. Somebody risked money, and after an event is over, their wager is worth more or less than what they actually risked. And so at the end of the day, ingesting real-time data seems uncomplicated. Where it gets tricky is trying to assign each wager to a particular event or market. There's so much more mapping work than anyone would ever understand. Let's just take a team. Really simple. I see Seton Hall in the background, so I assume there's New Jersey up there. Let's say it was the New York Jets. And for just as a very easy NFL team, you could see 25 to 30 different abbreviations on a betting ticket to describe the New York Jets. NYJ, New York Jets, Jets. NY Jets. And there's just so many different variations, and we need to make sure that the system knows that this bet on the Jets, especially if it's a game in December, you have the Winnipeg Jets, that's a professional hockey team, you have the New York Jets, how do we make sure that this wager is attributed properly to a bet attempted to be placed on the New York Jets? And because there's so many different platforms out there with over 100 licensed regulated operators in North America, there's a lot of mapping, normalizing, and cleaning of data. And that's really important that that's done quickly and in real time, because you need to have clean, normalized data going through the system, running through the algorithms and models in real time to ensure that you can identify instances of abnormalities and get them to an analyst to investigate in a time frame prior to bets being paid out. So even if we catch these abnormalities an hour before the game and the game's 3 hours long, we have to investigate it, get reports out, get information back, and send something out on alert on the game prior to that game ending. Because once that game ends, those sports books are going to pay all those folks. And once you pay somebody who basically manipulated or might have participated nefariously, they're going to take the money and run. Trying to recuperate that money after it's been paid is borderline impossible in a lot of cases. So it's about the quality of data that we get too, and ensuring that that data comes in is quickly, clean, normalized, able to funnel through the system, get to an analyst, get reports out, receive information back if we have requests from operators, and make a determination really quickly in real time, which is why we're actually using more and more AI. Because at the end of the day, we need to be better and better at identifying what is a real abnormality of substance and of concern to us as quickly as possible. Timing really does matter when detecting these type of things in the sports betting world.
But even with all of these tools and resources and teams of people in place, licensed operators, regulators, and monitors can only do their work in one part of the market. And despite the hope that legal sports betting would kill the demand, there is still a large and constantly shifting segment of the sports betting industry that is operating outside their authority, presenting them with new legal challenges every day.
You know, Lou talks about the jurisdiction of the division and the jurisdiction of the Casino Control Commission and how broad of a grant of authority the legislature gave to those agencies in New Jersey. There is a really interesting legal issue that's playing out, not necessarily as much in New Jersey right now, but in a couple of other states, relating to oversight, for lack of a better term, over illegal gambling. So in Pennsylvania, you know, in neighboring Pennsylvania, for example, there are in convenience stores, there are quote unquote skill-based slot machines that have popped up. They look like a duck, they quack like a duck, they talk like a duck, they certainly look like slot machines. And the legal justification is, no, there is an element of skill to them, and therefore they are not slot machines. They are amusement devices that you can play and win money on and whatnot, but they are not slot machines. There is a fascinating legal question playing out in the Pennsylvania courts now over who has jurisdiction over those games, because there is an interpretation of the Gaming Act that says the Gaming Control Board has jurisdiction over that which is legal and does not have jurisdiction over that which is not legal. And so for the Gaming Control Board to be able to say these games are illegal and therefore you need to stop them, there's a jurisdictional question there because of the way the statute is written. Is it a law enforcement question versus a Gaming Control Board question? I think the same is true with respect to illegal offshore betting websites that are still very, very popular in the United States. Despite the spread of legal gambling, the efforts by industry operators, by regulators, by others to educate the public that there is legal regulated online gaming and there is illegal unregulated online gaming. Many people don't learn the difference until they don't get their money back from an illegal unregulated online gaming company. They call Lou and Lou says there's not a whole lot I can do for you because they're illegal and unregulated. But the question becomes, if you want to prosecute them or you want to bring an action, who has jurisdiction to do that? And there's this question about, do gaming regulators, based on how they were created, have jurisdiction over illegal activity as well as legal activity, or is that something you have to send to the Attorney General's office or to whoever else? So when you talk about boundaries, that's another interesting boundary issue that the industry is struggling with right now, which is, where does the legal regulator's jurisdiction end when conduct that is clearly illegal but gaming has popped up? Perhaps only a question some of us on the law professor side could love, but it's fascinating because it has real consequences. If there's illegal activity going on, who's prosecuting it?
Yeah, and it goes beyond that, Chris, and you and I have talked till we're blue in the face on this issue. You know, our powers stop at entities that have contracts with casinos to operate, especially with sports and internet gaming. There are numerous companies out there, and we get the reports on a weekly basis. You know, I can't get my money back. I tried to withdraw. And these are all companies not licensed and regulated by the Division of Gaming Enforcement or any other U.S. state gaming regulator. And we're not talking about companies that are based in New Jersey that are doing this. We're talking about multinational corporations. We're talking about entities that are in Costa Rica, that are in Curacao, that are in the Isle of Man. So it goes beyond what just my powers are as a gaming regulator in New Jersey. Yes, I can send a cease and desist, but you know, my ability to enforce that beyond the boundaries of the state of New Jersey are severely limited. Same for the criminal prosecutors we work with. You know, their powers are to enforce the criminal laws in the state of New Jersey, and the ability to get to someone outside the boundaries of the state is increasingly difficult. And it's a situation that, you know, state legislatures are going to have to look at or beyond.
Enforcement gaps are a serious concern that have been raised by various factions. The American Gaming Association, the industry's leading professional association, has publicly criticized the Department of Justice for failing to shut down offshore betting sites as the, quote, only law enforcement entity that can credibly address these illegal offshore sportsbooks and casinos, unquote. A coalition of seven state gaming authorities also recently implored the federal government to provide greater assistance to state regulators seeking to prosecute illegal gaming activity. cease and desist letters from state gaming boards to the operator of the popular offshore site Bovada, have led to its restriction in some jurisdictions. But this is more symbolic than actual, since anyone with a VPN can bypass those restrictions. It's unclear to me what specific actions the AGA and state regulators would like the DOJ to take. While some of the federal laws I mentioned at the beginning of the episode would allow the prosecution of U.S.-based banks, payment processors, or other businesses who advertise or facilitate unregulated offshore betting, the possibility of reaching and prosecuting the actual operators seems pretty remote. State legislatures are certainly looking to address some of the gray area activities that Lou and Chris mentioned. An assembly bill was recently proposed in New Jersey that would make so-called sweepstakes wagering unlawful. Sweepstakes sports betting functions almost exactly like traditional online sports betting, but uses a virtual currency that can be purchased with and then exchanged for actual money. Florida is also considering legislation that would make sweepstakes illegal, although it more broadly makes participating in online sports wagering a misdemeanor offense and operation of an online sports betting site a felony. And some states who originally jumped on the legal sports betting bandwagon are now reversing course. Members of the Vermont General Assembly recently introduced a bill to repeal the legalization of sports betting and the state lottery. The Maryland State Senate is considering a similar measure. It's not entirely clear why some states might want to walk back their sports betting laws while others are still considering legalization. While legal sports betting conveys many benefits to states and their residents, it also clearly contributes to some serious social harms. Could this drive a backlash against the industry? Or is it a response to concerns about the impact on athletes and the culture of sports entertainment? These are some of the issues I'll be addressing in upcoming episodes of Season 2. Hearsay from the Sidelines is a collaboration of Seton Hall Law School and Culture and Sports. Research and writing by me, Sarah Grass, with the help of my amazing research assistants, Emily Radish and Lauren Vuolo. Music by my son, Robert. Produced by Sarah Grass and Dr. Jeremy Piasecki, Executive Director of Culture and Sports. Links to all available academic and primary legal sources, media, music, transcription, and other materials mentioned in this episode are available on the Hearsay from the Sidelines show page, hearsayfromthesidelines.com. And if you like this show, check out cultureandsports.com, where you'll find more articles, shows, webinars, summits, and courses for sports leaders of all levels.